Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News.
From high above the milkpacking district in the heart of beautiful Southeast Portland, Oregon, this, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson, alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
Umpqua dairy products have been recalled in Oregon. A sketch has been released in Beaverton's Sex Park Assault, or Park Sex Assault.
I was going to ask where that was and if I could leave the show early today.
And the Hung Far Low sign may soon be rehung.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, I give to you Legion of News.
State health officials and Umpqua. Maybe I should say who I am first. I am off to a bad start this morning. Would you
like me to start everything over again?
Just announce me again. Don't have to start everything announce me again so I can come in on the right note.
Are you sure you wouldn't like to take a moment where you just sort of find your emotional center, Dawn? We can do that if you like. All right. Here's what happened moments ago, right? Just as she began speaking, Dawn reached over and inadvertently unplugged the headphone preamplifier.
Yeah.
Just lock, stock, and barrel.
Yeah.
All right. You want to take another running start at that?
Yes.
Have you found your core?
No. I still don't have the thing to plug into my laptop. So.
All right.
So I'm just all a flutter this morning, Mr. Emerson. I'm letting down the listeners, I know.
All right. It's okay. Just hold on. Everybody just stand by for a second.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News.
Again. As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when this hour began. And now, without further ado, I give you Legion of News.
Good afternoon. I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Thursday, August 19th, 2010. State health officials and Umpqua dairy products have issued a recall due to salmonella contaminations. At least 23 people have been sickened and 2 have been hospitalized, according to officials. The outbreak has unfolded slowly, and it was just recently that we were able to confirm the matching salmonella strain in the Umpqua milk plant, said Paul Slack, MD, Oregon Public Health Division. The risk to consumers is very low. We have had approximately 1 illness reported for every million containers that Umpqua has sold during this period. I said the following numbers of people have been infected by county, 6 in Douglas, 3 in Marion, 3 in Jackson. I'm not going to read you all of those, but the median age of those sickened by the products has been 13 years. The recall affects the following products purchased on or prior to Monday, August 16th, milk, half and half, and cream with an expiration date of September 5th under the Umpqua Dairy, Cascade, Great Value, Lady Lee, Market of Choice, and Sherm's brand labels. Also buttermilk under those same labels. Orange juice and fruit drink with an expiration date of September 15th, and Eddy Fluid milk products stamped with a plant code 4162. If you have any questions about your Umpqua dairy products and their safety and such, you can call them. There's a toll-free number, 888-672-MILK, which is 6455. That's 888-672-MILK. Or you can go online to umpquadairy.com, and they'll tell you, I guess, if you're... if your buttermilk is going to make you keel over.
You know, what's interesting is when you talk about there being some sort of a recall on what did you call it? Orange drink? Is that what
yes.
you called it? Orange drink sounds like one of those things that is either not real, you know, it's like one of those astronaut foods from the 50s, or it's like a euphemism they would have in the South for any chilled beverage of your choice.
Should I just ignore that strange humming sound?
I was actually just going to say that, the amazing thing was that it actually wasn't there until you colossally bungled the opening of the program. And so now I believe that you have actually caused a spirit or djinn of some kind. To come in to enter the studio, so I'm going to look into that here.
So,
you plunge on ahead, and I will endeavor to understand where that noise is coming from.
Beaverton police released a sketch Wednesday of a man wanted in connection with a sexual assault involving a 13-year-old boy. Beaverton Police Department spokeswoman Pam Yazzolino said the assault happened while the boy was picking blackberries in Fano Creek Park, about 150 yards south of the Denny Road entrance. The boy, and perhaps the attacker, was at the park between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. Tuesday. Officers said the boy ran home and told his mother, who notified police. Police searched the area with a canine, but were unable to find the attacker. Police described the man as white, 50 to 60 years old, 6 foot 1 inches tall, with average build and balding. Seen wearing a Hawaiian shirt with white flowers and leaves and mirrored metal frame sunglasses. If you go online to one of our local news organizations, you can find the sketch. Basically, any kind of skinny, scrawny-looking old guy with a soul patch and a hipster beard wearing aviator shades could be this guy.
Really? So if you've seen this man
yeah.
or any of the thousands of men who look like him,
yeah,
you'll want to investigate that.
There's nothing really too noticeable about him. Just a bull leapt into the packed grandstands of a Spanish bull ring and ran amok, charging and trampling spectators and leaving 40 people injured. Video, which you can find online quite easily, and I suggest that you go do that as soon as possible, showed the bull jumping several meters high out of the ring, clearing two barriers before landing in the stands, and raising a panic as he lurched through the screaming crowd, charging and tossing everything he could.
Which is awesome, by the way.
The 1,100-pound animal was brought under control by experienced bull handlers after several minutes, and sadly, he was later killed. The incident occurred Wednesday at the Tafalla Arena in the northern region of Navarra during an event attended by about 3,500 spectators, in which mostly young people try to get a bull to charge at them so they can dodge it. Unlike standard bullfights, the bulls are not usually killed in these events. This bull had already attempted to jump into the stands twice. After damaging a horn, he was about to be returned to the corral and replaced with another bull when he just decided to take a quick run at the stands and leap into them and show his enraged fury.
It really is was one of the best things I've ever seen. So we're going to continue to talk about it in just a second. There's going to be actually about 4 or 5 seconds of silence here while I unplug something and plug it back in.
So talk amongst yourselves here.
Everybody, just pretend that we're taking a moment to ponder life and the transient nature thereof. All right. All right, so there we are. So we're gonna play through that pain today.
Do we have no ticker music? Because the ticker would kind of cover it up a little.
We do.
It?
It's just one of those things that I'm. It's one of those things that's frustrating me because it's a small low frequency hum that only I and elephants can actually hear. And so we're gonna act as though it's just not there. Here's the thing about the bull video, though. If you've seen the video of which we're speaking, which is this, where the bull is. Correct me if I'm wrong. He's there for the sole purpose of, quote, amusing people by just sort of being taunted until he charges at them.
Right.
And then if you watch the video, which is available on the Intertron, and you see the bull actually not only charging at the people, but then actually sort of, it's like...
He jumps up on a thing and then leaps over the wall into the stands like, ha-ha!
It's astounding. I mean, he actually makes it sort of all the way up over the railing into the stands, into the bleachers, where he then just starts charging upward. I mean, he just starts bolting directly up through the stands into the people. And you know, all of whom seem a little, I would say, inexplicably surprised that he's annoyed or that he's been sort of put out by the entire thing. So it really is, it's glorious. And you said the greatest thing when you came in today, that it was one of those moments where you suddenly realized exactly, you appreciated my love for, you know, how I always root for the animal. Mm. So whenever man is versus nature, that I always root for nature every single time.
Yeah, I was at home and this came up on the TV. The sound was off and I was on the laptop and my husband was in the room and he went, "Oh, Don, look at this. Look. And I turned and looked at it and I just immediately started like out loud going, "Go, bull, go, go."
No, it's fantastic. It's one of those things that really is, it warms the cockles of your heart. Because, and you just say the bull was then taken out and destroyed at some point,
well,
right?
Well, yeah.
Because that's what they always do. Because it's the bull's fault somehow that they were sticking it with spears, that they had a guy in there.
Yeah,
was,
that they put him in a ring and were taunting him.
Some guy whose whole job was just to sort of, give it a good whacking with a knife. But I like to think that the bull went out, you know, he died as he lived. He remained unbowed and unbroken, even at the end.
Yeah, 40 people were treated, primarily for minor injuries. There was one 10-year-old boy who was in intensive care after the bull reportedly fell on him. The bull weighed 1,100 pounds.
Wow.
But again, and one man was gored in the back. But again, you know, this is a sport.
Yeah. You think it's a sport? Ask the bull.
That's about taunting and torturing an animal.
Yeah.
And then people go and sit around and go, "Hooray!
That was awesome.
I'm entertained by this." So,
Remember that time we bested a thing that had a brain the size of a bean? Yeah, we rule. So whenever you start feeling low and you start feeling down about these things, about humanity and about the state of affairs, I would just go and watch that video maybe two or three times back to back. And if that didn't put a smile on your step, then my friends, you are beyond assistance. You are listening to Legion of News right here at PDX.FM. My name is Rick Emerson. Thank you for joining us. Don Taylor is alongside me. We will return to the news in just one moment. Don't forget, you can be listening to this program on your mobile device, on your handheld. You just go to mobile.pdx.fm to enjoy this broadcast on your smartphone or on your what have you. That is mobile.pdx.fm. It is also available via iTunes and an archived form at pdx.fm and at legionofnews.com. This is Don Taylor.
Oh, we got a nice message. Somebody in the text box does say that the little buzzing sound isn't so bad, the low hum. It lends sort of a Silent Hill air to the whole proceedings.
Really?
Yes.
You're the undead one.
Of course.
All right.
A fan fell 14 feet during the Angels-Red Sox game at Fenway Park yesterday night. The man fell near Gate B. Witnesses said the man was unconscious after the fall and lying in a pool of blood. They said he had cuts on his face and was taken away from the scene on a stretcher with a neck brace. He was taken to Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center with head and neck injuries. Police interviewed witnesses at the scene and crews moved in to clean up the mess. "Yeah, it was right behind us," said one fan. "We didn't know if he fell from the very top or if he fell from a stairway, but they kept looking up. He had blood on his eye, though. It looked like he was hit by a foul ball, but he'd fallen down the steps."
Let me back up for a second. I'm unclear about this. So he was...
I'm guessing at some point they will say that alcohol was involved.
But the geography of the story is a little bit puzzling to me. So describe again, if you will, please, the nature of the fall.
He fell... I guess it says he fell 14 feet, so I'm thinking he fell over one of those railings,
so sort of
from one level to another.
Okay, yeah, so from one balcony, basically, to a somewhat lower balcony.
It says he fell down the steps. I'm just assuming he probably, if he fell 14 feet, he probably went flying over a thing.
It is sort of amazing to me that they don't have, you know, that they don't have sort of measures in place to make, you can never really make sure. I mean, there's no defense against idiots. Yeah. To make it at least more difficult for some guy to go there and to get half in the bag on the ballpark giganto beer and then say, "Hey, look at me. Take a picture of me leaning over the wham," and then write down on, you know.
Well, there's a lot of drunkenness and stupidity, particularly at baseball games. And then, when you're in the upper levels, there are these steep steps that go down and they end with like a little metal railing that ends about the middle of your thigh.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's kind of like, if you started taking a tumble down those things, you just go, whoo, right off the edge.
No, that's
I think about that because of my obsessive phobic fear of falling off of things.
Well, and that's one of those things where I guess they must realize at some point that there's only so much they can do. But my only thing is that the guy who tumbles and falls off the balcony at Comiskey Park or wherever, he always lands on somebody else. That's the thing that I would be worried about if I was those guys. By the way, I'd like to thank whoever it was that said that low level hum lent a Silent Hill aura, because now I'm just picturing you just going, And so meet me at Silent Hill. Love, Jenna. Or whatever the hell her name is. That creepy letter that she reads at the beginning of the game.
Yeah, you need to go over and remove the painting Sarah Dillon did of Butters and find a clue from behind it.
Jesus.
And that will help us kill something with one eye and tentacles.
Can I just tell you, I just did this the last time I was... I don't think about Silent Hill all that much because it creeps me out. But I was actually on... What was it? It was on the. It must have been on Gizmodo or something. They were doing some. But it was, they had some article about the increasing fright level that's inherent in most video games. And then they ended it with, of course, everything on the net ends with the obligatory countdown of the 10 best something. And they had this 10 creepiest video games of all time article, along with sort of, you know, video captures and video samples from the games. And they had just a big montage so you could watch, which I did. Inexplicably sitting at home in my office alone at 2 a.m. with the lights off because that's how I work. And so I'm watching this 5-minute montage of just terrifying video game sequences. And I don't know when the last time any of y'all like played a video game was. But I mean, things have come a bit of a way since Zaxxon. So it was, you know, Silent Hill, and then Doom 3. And then BioShock, you know, and then it was just like a whole, and then I was just all rattled. And then I just had to go watch Ron Popeil infomercials in the other room because I was all, it made me all flustery. All right, this is Legion of News. You are listening to PDX.FM. This is Dawn Taylor.
A woman waving a sign for a Vancouver pizza restaurant said she was attacked and robbed at knife point by a man who approached her on a bike. The victim, who did not want to be identified, said she was standing near Domino's Pizza on 4th Plain Boulevard and Grant Street at about 5 p.m. last night. Actually, it says about 5 p.m. Thursday, which would be today, which would mean this hasn't happened yet.
I was just going to say, so note to that woman, you can avoid the whole thing now. What you got to do is just stay in bed in defiance of prophecy.
If only she had identified herself, we could warn her. anyway, I'm assuming this actually happened last night. A man punched her in the jaw. He then pulled out a knife and demanded money. The woman gave him $20, but was able to keep her wallet. The victim said she suffered a fractured ankle, sprained knee, and sore jaw. Raymond Johnson lives nearby, and he said he spoke with the victim just minutes after the attack. She stopped and talked to me for a little bit. She was swinging her sign for the Domino's, Johnson said. I don't know how to explain anything that stupid.
Okay.
The victim described the attacker as a black man, 19 to 23 years old, clean-shaven with a medium build. He was seen riding a small bike.
And so the deal is she's out there, and she's one of the sign twirlers, and a guy just bikes up and punches her in the face for no reason.
And then says, give me money!
And here's what sucks about that. I mean, apart from the actual punching, is, and look, and I know that these are hard times. Everybody's got to do what they can to, you know, to support themselves and their family. So, I'm not gonna malign anybody's desire to work. But you must be sitting out there, and you're in. The, you know, yesterday it's all muggy and it's hot, and the sun is beating down. You're twirling a sign for like $4 an hour after taxes, and you're thinking to yourself, well, at the bare minimum, at the very least, my life can't get any worse. Whack! And then just a guy by, not even in a car. A guy bicycles up.
Guy had a tiny
up.
Bike. One of those tiny little bikes. Clown bikes.
He had a miniature bike, pedals up and whacks you in the face and then leaves. It's just sad. All right. Well, what are you going to do? It is not a world of men, as Ricky Roma would say.
No.
All right. You are listening to Legion of News here at PDX-FM. Don't forget the Rick Emerson radio program comes your way at 1 o'clock. Coming up today, we'll have a top five. We have the top five songs from January 9th, 1989. As we spin the wheel of time. January 9th, 1989. Also, Geek Watch on the way today. Obama Watch on the way. And Mr. Peter Carlin from the Oregonian will join us here in the studio. That is the Rick Emerson Show coming up at 1 o'clock today. This is Dawn Taylor.
A sculpture project towering over the South 24th Street Bridge in Council Bluffs, Iowa, is supposed to be symbolic of man, machine, and transformation, a modern relic representative of an area with a rich agricultural history. But many local residents have an issue with the artwork. One driver rear-ended another car on Monday and told police it was because he was distracted by the giant, terrifying sculptures. What we're about to hear here is another local man named Chris Regal, who drives past these sculptures every day on his way to work.
I look at this thing at driving when they were starting it, and I'm like, it looks like Freddy Krueger's hands coming down trying to grab somebody.
Chris Regal drives past the sculptures every day to and from work.
It looks like somebody just went to the junkyard, grabbed some scrap metal, slapped it all together, and called it art.
Do we have a do we have any sort of a picture of the artwork?
I tried to get a good picture that I could show to you, and I really couldn't get anything good that I could print out to show you because it was mostly there was video and then there were some really bad little pictures. It's modern art sculptures that are made of long, sharp, jagged, pointy pieces of stuff that are pointy, and there's four of them, two on either side of the highway, and they're like 60 feet high. And they really are just discordant and terrifying looking. Todd Graham of the Iowa West Foundation, which commissioned artist Albert Paley to create them as part of this multi-million-dollar thing that's going on in Council Bluffs, where they're getting all of these huge abstract structures in town to try and make their city a destination for people to come, including one giant sculpture just called Molecule Man, which I found kind of awesome. But it was $3 million for these giant, jaggedy spires. The fellow from the Iowa West Foundation said, "We're hearing a wide range of opinions, from negative to positive. Public art generates dialogue and discussion. Initially, new installations often generate negative feedback." He pointed to the Eiffel Tower in Paris as an example. When it was built, it caused an outrage. When I was looking up information on this story, this piece, which is called The Odyssey, there's also, you could find comments online at local newspapers in Council Bluff where people say things like, "Dear Lord, that cost $3 million, well, that and was... it looks evil."
Kill it with fire. That was going to be my next question, actually, is that when you're talking about there being a $3 million price tag on a piece of art that people either find, well, in this case, terrifying, or at the very least, they are sort of indifferent to, where does that money come? And when I say art, I'm specifically in Portland thinking about that little, that swinging brush ball thing by Powell's.
Across the street from Powell's, yeah.
Who, did we pay for that?
Yes, yes, we did.
Really?
Yes.
All right. I mean, I'm not saying art isn't important for life and so forth, but I mean, that piece of art isn't important for life. Let's just put it that way.
Well, this is another little tiny bit of audio. This is a woman named Vicky Hovan, who does not live in Council Bluffs, but who was driving through town on her way to Colorado.
All right.
You know, you're looking at it, and it almost like shocks you. Like, what is that?
She's passing through Council Bluffs on her way to Colorado.
Just doesn't look right. It just doesn't look inviting here. You know, just, come on, people, stop in. We're going to stab you.
Tell me.
That probably isn't a sound effect that you want associated with your city. That's not the slogan they're really looking for. All right. You are listening to Legion of News right here at PDX.FM. Don't forget it's available on iTunes later on today, or you can be downloading it in archive form via legionofnews.com or PDX.FM. This is Don Taylor.
Rookie running back LeGarrette Blount capped off a feisty night practice for his Tennessee Titans team with a short punch to the helmet of defensive end Eric Bakhtiari a few moments after having his own helmet ripped off for the second time in as many plays. You may recall LeGarrette Blount as being suspended by the University of Oregon for 8 games last season.
He's the puncher.
For punching Boise State defensive end Brian Hout after a game on September 3rd. Without much of a senior season going for him, what with being suspended and all, he went undrafted, and then the Titans brought him in as a free agent. So now, you know, he's in practices, and now he's like punching his teammates in the head.
I think somebody has already started carving out his own particular niche.
Blount, however you pronounce his name, had just returned to the Titans on Wednesday night after being excused since Sunday for personal reasons. He was carrying the ball in a drill near the goal line when his helmet came off, and he kept his feet moving toward the end zone. The play ended with some pushing and shoving, then Blount threw a right into Bakhtiari's face mask. Blount quickly talked to the coach before leaving the field. "He apologized, and I said he didn't have to apologize," Fisher said. "It's football. It's training camp."
I like the idea that the personal reasons he were excused for were that he had somebody to punch in another state. And he's like, "Coach, I'm going to be back on Tuesday, but I got to swing through Des Moines. There's a guy there that needs a punch in the face, and then I'm going to do just a quick little hook down through Florida, and I'm going to knee a man in the groin in Tallahassee, and then I will be back in time for the early afternoon scrimmage." All right, thank you so much. You are listening to Legion of News. This is Don Taylor at the Legion of News News Desk.
The Hung Far Low sign has been refurbished and will be rehung in Chinatown.
Rehung.
Ah. Yeah. The Hung Far Low sign will hang once more in Portland's Chinatown with the unveiling of the sign at the First Thursday Art Event on September 2nd. The sign was taken down during the 2008-2009 renovation of the Hung Far Low building, located at Northwest 4th Avenue and Cooch, when an inspection of the building's roof showed the sign's support structure was deteriorating. Some details about the unveiling are still up in the air, said Anne Mangan, spokeswoman for the Portland Development Commission, but owners of the restaurant Ping, which operates out of the ground floor of the Hung Farlow building, hope to have the street shut down for the occasion. Mangan said that the sign means a lot to anybody who grew up in Portland because it represents the history of Chinatown. Also, it was in National Lampoon in their feature where they make fun of signs that look dirty.
Yeah.
It's something people have just always associated with downtown, Mangan said. People are so fond of it. It's iconic. Portlanders rallied to bring the sign back to Chinatown and raised $8,600 towards the effort through T-shirt sales and other donations. The PDC put $45,000 in grant money towards restoring the sign. The cost to rehang the sign, which is a two-day process, is expected to be $77,461.
Now, there are multiple locations of Hung Farlow, right? There's the one downtown, but even that's moved, right? Hadn't it? It's not in the same place it originally was.
That's why they're calling it the Hung Farlow building now, because the restaurant itself
Because the restaurant itself is,
there.
Yeah, it's, I mean, but the restaurant, it didn't close. It just went somewhere else,
that
I think.
I don't know.
I don't know. All I know is that that's one of those things that when I moved to Portland, everybody was like, you got to go to this place, Hung Farlow, where, and then of course, I had one of those things that I won't say it surprised me, but it's one of those sort of slices of Portland culture that I wasn't really aware of, but then I then immediately became privy to, is that in the space of, the first 6 months that I was here, I had three different wedding receptions to go to, all of them at that place.
Really?
Yeah, and that was, that was my introduction to a certain stripe of the Portland community.
I've never actually been in that building. At all.
It was a hole. I mean, it's just unsurprising. At least it wasn't. Who was it that got married the first time? It was the first wedding that I went to of a friend who lived here. The reception was at Hung Farlow because it had sort of this wonderful, horrible, trashy appeal. You know, you kind of go in there, and it looked like the ceiling was about to give in on you at any moment because it was just, and there was like big, it was the tiles like we have here in this office where they sort of look like styrofoam, but with the big brown, like, water stains, and then it sort of sagged down in the middle. Also, it was
Gus Van Sant use it for a couple of scenes in Drugstore Cowboy?
Probably. And it was so dim, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face, which was just as well. And apparently the drinks are unbelievably stiff and really cheap. But it was really, it was like sitting in the alternate rec room of a disused Knights of Columbus Hall in Akron, Ohio, in a sort of great way, you know. All right, here's Don Taylor at the Legion of News News Desk.
Sheriff's deputies in Michigan are investigating a Wednesday morning collision between an Amish buggy and a pickup truck. The crash happened in Clare County's Sheridan Township at about 9 a.m., deputies said the buggy was traveling on Cullenville Road when a newer dark blue GMC or Chevy pickup sideswiped the buggy. A man, woman, and their three children were inside at the time of the collision. Authorities said the five people were either thrown from the buggy or jumped out following the impact. Deputies said the pickup truck driver left the scene, as did the horse and buggy. One of the children, a six-year-old girl, was taken by her family to a nearby farm with what police describe as fairly significant head injuries. Police believe the truck's mirror might have struck the girl's head. The girl was flown to Saginaw Hospital for treatment, and she was in critical condition. Police said the rest of the family had only minor injuries. Deputies want the public, although, I'm not going to ask the public here to be on the lookout. If you're listening from Michigan, you might want to keep an eye out for a truck that looks like it hit a buggy.
Just, FYI.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's do science news.
Excellent. It's Science on the March. This is Legion of News right here on PDX.FM.
By learning an utterly superfluous technique for scratching their backs, wild chimpanzees are displaying even more evidence that humanity's closest living relatives are capable of what might be deemed culture. In recent years, researchers have accumulated many examples of chimpanzees apparently learning relatively complex ideas that get passed down over generations, much like in human cultures. For instance, chimps in the wild have developed a variety of specialized toolkits for foraging army ants that differ across various regions. Still, not all scientists are convinced that apes can learn practices by mimicking their companions, at least not in the wild. Instead, one could argue that generations of chimps might either instinctively know or independently figure out techniques for accomplishing certain tasks, a process that might resemble the learning by imitation seen in humans. The new evidence that chimpanzees are indeed capable of monkey see, monkey do, came from the Sanso chip community in Uganda. According to researcher Catherine Hobater, I would sometimes spend days trying to find the chimps, and then they might travel through everything from muddy swamps and thick undergrowth to colonies of army ants before there'd be a good chance to film them. But then, when you do get to observe them in their natural habitat, it's an incredibly rewarding experience, and you completely forget about the fact you're sitting in the mud with ants in your socks. One chimpanzee there was named Tinka, a roughly 50-year-old male who had near-total paralysis in both hands. Until recently, Sanso chimpanzees would encounter large numbers of snares intended for bush pigs and kinds of antelopes known as duiker, leading one-in-one adult chimps in the community to have permanent disabilities. To compensate for his paralysis, Tinka invented a new way to groom himself, using a woody vine. It's similar to if you used a towel on your own back to dry your back, except in this case, rather than moving the towel, Tinka held the liana, which is the name of the woody vine, taut with his feet and moved his body against it. It's always sad to see chimpanzees with these debilitating injuries. On the other hand, it was incredible to see just how individuals like Tinka are able to innovate new techniques in order to overcome these disadvantages.
Have you seen that video of the crow that has figured out how to make the tool and to use it and to fish out the thing? So that combined with, when you're talking about, you know, the chimpanzees being able to learn behaviors and so forth, doesn't it seem like that ought to be bigger news?
You'd think so.
Like,
that, you know.
Like it ought to be in the front page of a newspaper somewhere. Like, holy Christ, animals learning how to use tools, presumably, you know, for war against us at some point.
Here's a drawing she did of how Tinka would wrap the vine around a branch and then scratch his back with, like, holding onto it with his foot and... It's very elaborate.
Well, this is like, as I've said many times, this is a thing that I've raised the alarm about in the past, and nobody ever seems to find it as unnerving as I do. It's that, what is the gorilla or whatever they have in San Diego that can talk? It does the sign language.
I don't know.
You know, because there's a whole book about it, Coco. And then there was the Seinfeld where they named George, you know, George got the nickname Coco because, hey, you're like that chimp that can talk. So why is that not a thing that people are just agog at? The idea that there's, like, a gorilla that can talk to us.
I don't know. Have you ever seen any of these studies where they've done things with squirrels? Where a squirrel knows that there's food in, like, say, a bird feeder, and then you try all these different elaborate ways to keep the squirrel out of the bird feeder. And squirrels are... they have tiny little brains, like the size of peas, but the one thing that they're good at is figuring out ways to get at food. And they will build these Rube Goldberg contraptions to, like, fling themselves from something to something and then go hand over hand down wires like they're in the Great Escape and then shimmy down something and then fashion a hook make their own Leatherman out of a paperclip.
It's
amazing.
We ought to be exploiting that technology somehow, you know, to battle terrorism, let's say. I mean, if we're not already. That's the sort of thing where I just figured that there is some secret squirrel testing lab. Deep underneath the Mojave Desert, and the government is, as we speak, creating the platoons of squirrel, soldiers.
I wouldn't be surprised.
All right. Here's Don Taylor with more Science on the March.
The White House is facing a growing challenge to claim that most of the oil from the Deepwater disaster has disappeared from the Gulf of Mexico, as at least two independent teams of scientists reported new evidence of oil persisting deep under the surface of the sea. Earlier this month, government scientists reported that about 75% of the oil had been captured, burned off, evaporated, or broken down in the Gulf. But University of South Florida scientists, returning from a 10-day research voyage, said they found oil on the ocean floor in the DeSoto Canyon, a prime spawning ground for fish far to the east of BP's Rogue oil well. Preliminary results suggested that oil was getting into the phytoplankton, the microscopic plants at the bottom of the Gulf food chain. The idea that this could have an impact on the food web and on the biological system is certainly a reality, David Hollander, a marine geochemist, told the University of South Florida's radio station. Smaller organisms would likely to be affected the most, he added. Fish eggs, if they're in that environment, they may not be consuming it, but it's like paint in the air. You breathe it at low concentrations for a long enough time, you're still going to have that response. Scientists from the University of Georgia also disputed the White House claim, releasing their own analysis suggesting 70 to 79% of the oil in the Gulf of Mexico remained in the water.
Well, that's great.
The idea that 75% of the oil is gone and of no concern to the environment is just absolutely incorrect, said Charles Hopkinson, a marine science professor at the university.
I mean, look, I've got a pair of pants at home that I spilled some, olive oil or something? It's like something you cook with or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that was like...
you were cooking.
Yes, I was It doesn't matter. Anyway,
I don't even want to know what you're doing with it.
No, but it's just, you know,
it on your pants.
It's just like the cooking oil. Isn't it just like a patch of oil on the front of my jeans? That's like 2 years ago. And it's like an inch by an inch, and it's still there. So the idea that like 200 million gallons of it will suddenly vanish after like a week and a half just rings a little bit false.
You think? You think they might have been fibbing on that?
There's oil in my driveway that no one can get rid of. I mean, and that's just a smallish pool of it.
Yeah, I can't get a mayonnaise spot out of my sweater.
Yeah, so I'm not gonna say that it's I'm not gonna say that they're going out of their way to deceive us, but it does. The anecdotal evidence would indicate that is the case. Yes. Here's Dawn Taylor.
That's all of our science news.
Excellent. There you go. There's Science on the March for Thursday right here on Legion of News at pdx.fm.
I have too many papers here.
Okay. Also, your spoon is too big. Don't forget, by the way, when you're listening to Legion of News, this program is made possible by many fine folks, including Mr. Michael Beatty. Speaking of cleaning and things that need to be taken out of other things, if you got some sort of a stain, some sort of a problem, some sort of a dinginess, some sort of a dirt, doesn't want to come out of your carpet or your upholstery, your tile, whatever it is, he can help you take care of that. You can reach Mr. Michael Beatty at 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. Now, whether you just moved into a place or whether you're getting ready to move on out and you want to make sure that the place looks good, you know, so you can rent it, so you can sell it, or whether you're just wanting to get your carpet back so it looks the way it did when you first bought it, first had it put in, you contact him and he can get your, one of the things he says, anything that your feet touch. And sometimes people think that, you know, tile is one of those things that doesn't need to be cleaned all that often. You think the tile actually just looks great all the time. And the problem isn't so much the tile occasionally as it is the grout. You get the areas between the tile stuff gets down in there, and after a while, you got to spend like 5 hours on your knees with a toothbrush trying to get it clean, or you could have somebody else do that for you. And I'll do residential and commercial cleaning and maintenance as well, which means once it gets back to looking great, you can help keep it that way forevermore. So write down this number, and you give them a call when you need something in your home cleaned, when you need your carpet or whatever restored to fantastic condition. It's 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. 533-3211, Mr. Michael Beatty, The Cleaning Solution. This is Dawn Taylor.
You know, several people have popped up in the text box to suggest that Michael Beatty might be able to help with the Gulf of Mexico. Or with your pants.
It's entirely possible. I'm going to bring the pants in. I'm going to show you tomorrow.
Okay.
All right. I'm not really going to do that.
A woman has filed a discrimination complaint against Disneyland for sending her home for wearing her hijab, a Muslim headscarf and symbol of faith, to work. Iman Boudil said that she has been sent home 4 times for wearing the scarf to work at Disneyland's Grand California Hotel, where she is a restaurant hostess.
I'm sorry, I was just wondering if I should ask what the difference between a hijab and a burqa is, and if you were likely to know the answer to that.
A hijab is merely a headscarf. It doesn't cover the face, so I think a burqa is much more. Has a lot more coverage.
It's an all-encompassing
cover.
Is this Disney? Is that the name of this kind? All right, let's...
Why would I work in the back? Well, because of the Disney look. And then I said, you know, you're just hiding me because of my hijabi look, because I look as a Muslim.
I don't understand what she's saying there. I mean, I understand the words that are coming out of her mouth, but I don't get what
Why would I work in the back? Well, because of the Disney look. And then I said, you know, you're just hiding me because of my hijabi look, because I look as a Muslim.
All right. I had her until about halfway through. I take it back. I actually can't understand some of the words that are coming out of her mouth there.
She says management offered her a job in the back. That was part of what she just said there. Out of public view, but she refused.
Either you accept to work in the back or you go home. Of course, I choose to be sent home. I'm not going to accept to work at the back.
Okay.
This whole story just annoys me. I mean, I suppose I might have some sympathy for her if she was working anywhere other than Disney.
Yeah, I don't think you're allowed to take a gig there and then complain that they micromanage their employees' behavior. I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Why I never.
They have really restrictive dress code and grooming rules, and those things are all laid down. I applied for a job at Disney once myself. I've known people who work. I know people right now who work for Disney, and all of that stuff is laid out for you in painful detail. When you are hired and when you sign on.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like if she wants to wear the headscarf, you know, to honor Ramadan, fine. You know, that's great. But the thing is, it's not part of what you're supposed to be wearing for your job.
Well,
and you agreed to this when you were hired.
And when you get the gig there, I mean, they lay out the whole that if you're some of this may have changed, but there was the thing that, like, you know, men weren't allowed to have facial hair, women weren't allowed to wear anything but stud earrings.
Yeah,
they would actually do the thing of it was like when you know those like when you watch Anne of Green Gables and she has the girls kneeling so she can measure their skirts or whatever the hell. They would measure your fingernails. If you're a female who works at Disneyland, there was at one time, I don't know if it still is the case, there was at one point an actual, like a swatch book that they would use to judge whether your fingernails were an appropriate color. Yeah. Because there were only certain shades that you, basically anyone should look like a whore. And so there were only certain shades of, like, red you were allowed to use to paint your fingernails. And they do spell all of that out in advance. And one can either opt to work there or not.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you're not considered a, they don't even call them employees. They call them cast members.
Right.
Because you are on stage when you're at work. You know, your clothes are a costume. The way you are groomed is part of the way you are presenting yourself to the public.
Glad we're on the same side of the issue here, Don Taylor.
So this woman just annoys me. So she can just piss right off.
All right, then.
Okay. TriMet reported a suspicious-looking object on a train that pulled into the airport terminus of the Red Line, agency officials said. The report did not affect the flight operations of the airport, but an airport camera showed police cars blocking access to the lower arrival lanes, but allowing cars to the upper drop-off lanes. This was about 6:30 p.m. last night, apparently. A bomb disposal unit was sent to the station, said TriMet spokeswoman Becky Witt. Police were viewing this as a credible threat. The train and platform were evacuated when the package was spotted. The all-clear was given about 6:30 p.m. Shuttle buses were being used to ferry passengers between Mount Hood Avenue stop and the PDX terminal.
Do you call it the terminus?
Yes, indeed.
Terminus. What does that mean?
The terminus of the Red Line would be the end of the line for the shuttle.
That's interesting. That's another one of those weird. That's like when you get a prescription from the pharmacist, and it has like the bizarre. It has an abbreviation on there, or when you get when the doctor will actually give you the paper prescription, and you look at it, and there's just a bunch of strange Latin abbreviations on there. It's like seeing the side of a house where the paint has sort of worn away in one place, and you can see the colors underneath from many, many generations back, where every now and again we'll just get these little flashes of Latin that appear in English that we just cling to, like, far after the fact. So that's way more interesting to me than the whole bomb threat, which never turns out to be an actual bomb.
You ever have those things where all of a sudden it's like a light bulb goes on over your head, and you suddenly realize the connection between words that you had never actually made the connection before?
Yes.
I that happened to me probably about a year ago. I was like driving in my car for some reason, and like, you know, la la la, circus music, blah blah blah, thinking words. And for no good reason, I suddenly realized the whole connection between the core, CORPS, where
right.
It's like a body and a corpsman who is a person, and corpse.
Right.
And then, of course, the Latin corpus, which means body. When you think of, like, Corpus Christi, which means body of Christ. And I was like, all of a sudden, I was thinking, corpse and core come from the same place. And then I thought, I suppose everyone in the world already knew that, but I had never actually connected that
before.
My
God, these words are all interrelated.
I know.
They're variations of the same thing. What a fool I've been. Yes.
And then I look over at my husband sometimes, and I go, and he looks really intent on something. And, like, once I said, now, what do you think about, honey? And he said, X-Men.
Graham crackers.
Yeah. And me, I'm sitting here going, the Latin foundations for these words are all the same.
Well, so. You know, that's it's part of the oppositional glue that keeps you and Patrick together. You're listening to Legion of News right here at PDX.FM. Don't forget, coming up today at 1 o'clock, the Rick Emerson Show at RickEmerson.com. We'll be talking to Mr. Peter Carlin from the Oregonian. We'll also have an Obama Watch Geek Watch top five songs from January 2nd, 1989 and more. Here is Don Taylor at the Legion of News News Desk.
About 3,700 Zooper strollers have been recalled for a frame latch failure. Patty Davis with the Consumer Product Safety Commission explains the safety concern.
When this frame latch comes undone, the stroller basically just collapses on your children. In fact, that happened to...
Hold on, just let me understand this.
I guess you're not supposed to do that?
I was just going to clarify that. So that's wrong, then. I've been doing it incorrectly all these years.
When this frame latch comes undone, the stroller basically just collapses on your children. In fact, that did happen to a 13-month-old and a 3-year-old who were in together in a stroller, and they got scratches and bruises.
You know, if your kids don't get scratches and bruises now, they're going to get them out on the street, sister. One way or the other, you got to toughen them up at some point.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but when you're actually creating a product before it goes to market, shouldn't, especially if it's a stroller, shouldn't one of the first things you test for to make sure it's not going to collapse in on onto an infant?
I'm also unclear about how a stroller can collapse inward, like, at all. You know what I mean? Because
a lot of them fold up for transport, and then you like, pull them open, and they latch open.
Right, but wouldn't you think that... I guess I'm thinking of the physics of it. If you know, you have it closed, and then you go and you open it sort of like a suitcase, and then you put your kids inside of there, unless you are picking it up and sort of just waving it around by the handle, or unless you're just running it into a wall because you're trying to enter, like, platform 9 3/4 or something.
As I would be if I had a child.
How is it folding up? It seems like the kid's own weight, even if it's just a baby, would be keeping it open.
Hence the terrible, terrible problem with the Zooper stroller and the recall.
Well, we're not parents, I guess. There's knowledge we don't have, Don.
Apparently, though, Davis says that there's a repair kit available through manufacturer LAN Enterprises.
And that's going to keep this frame latch from coming undone, and it eliminates the hazard.
All right, well, there you go.
Hooray!
Problem solved. Huzzah. This is Don Taylor at the Legion of News News Desk.
Moonstruck Chocolate Company, based in Portland, is recalling two of its popular chocolate collections, the 4-piece cream cone chocolate truffle collection and the 12-piece chocolate malted or malt cream cone chocolate truffles, were recalled because they may contain undeclared peanut butter, which can make people who are allergic to peanuts ill. The chocolate collections were distributed through Moonstruck company-owned Moonstruck Chocolate Cafes, the company website, and through various retailers nationwide. No illnesses have been reported.
That's hard to believe, Don. It's hard to believe that that peanut butter, which has apparently been in there for quite some time, has actually not sickened thousands of people, because I'm to understand that it's a virulent new allergy that is striking millions of Americans dead every single day.
Yeah, it's apparently, if you're even just near peanut butter...
If you think about peanut butter...
You'll just swell up like a tick.
If you just drive through Georgia at some point, I guess you just turn to ashes and bone.
Some children are so sensitive to it, if they even think about peanut butter, if the words peanut butter even pass through their minds... They just fall down and start convulsing.
You know, can I tell you the last time I flew, and it was on, I'm trying to remember if it was Delta Airlines, and I think it may have been, and it was one of those days where I had been so busy because I'd gotten up and I'd gone to work, and I was I got off work and went home and I grabbed my stuff and I had to get to the airport, and there was really I had no time to stop and eat, and I got to the airport, I don't know, but it was like 20 minutes before the plane was going to take off, so it wasn't really time to go order anything. So I go to the little gift shop place there, and I buy one of those. And it's one of those weird off-brands that you only see at the airport, you know? Best Snack, S-N-A-K, or something. And
which makes it even more offensive that it costs, like, 20 times more than something an actual real snack would cost at a supermarket or convenience.
But it's also deeply satisfying because it's one of those horrible, trashy foods that you allow yourself to eat on any kind of a trip or, you know, or like if you're doing a road trip or a plane flight or something, you just, you know, you stop and you go, well, I'm kind of on vacation. Sure, why not?
I don't normally eat circus peanuts.
It was awesome, though. It was this sort of like... It was one of those foods that was presumably healthy at some point in time when they first invented it. It was like a trail mix thing. But then they just filled it, you know, with like chocolate and brown sugar. And then they put everything in toffee and then they fried it. Anyway, but a lot of it was these sort of toffee peanut things, which are fantastic. And that's not a thing that I just sit around and eat like here. You know, like I don't ever go to like Safeway and look for toffee peanuts. But if I'm at the airport, that's a thing I'll absolutely buy. So I haven't eaten anything all day. I got this, and I paid like $9 for it, of course. It's like this massive bag of toffee peanuts. I got on the airplane. I got my book. I got my headphones. I've got the little blowy air, like, thing turned on above me in the seat. I'm leaning back. I'm relaxed. I'm ready to just, you know. And then they make the announcement over the, they go, we just want to let you know that there is somebody on board today with a peanut allergy. So, if you have any peanut items or items which may have been made in a factory containing peanuts, we're going to ask you not to open those or eat those during the flight today. And
screw that!
That's what I'm saying.
You have a peanut allergy, just don't eat peanuts.
That's what I'm saying. And so it should be noted, by the way, that I opened them and I ate them anyway.
Good
and everybody made it through the flight just fine, unsurprisingly. So here's Don Taylor at the Legion of News News Desk.
I hate people. Let's do our entertainment news.
Are you saying that wasn't entertaining just now? Your loathing of all humanity always puts a smile on my face, Don. Here's Don Taylor with your entertainment news on Legion of News.
The Hollywood plastic surgeon, known for performing 10 procedures on reality star Heidi Montag in one day, posted updates to his Twitter account in the moments before he was killed in a car accident. The Los Angeles Times reported that just minutes before his fatal crash on Monday, Dr. Frank Ryan, 50, tweeted about his dog, who was a passenger in the car as he drove down a Malibu highway. Border Collie Jill surveying the view from atop the sand dune, he tweeted at 4:10 p.m. local time, including a link to a picture of his beloved pooch at the beach. Ryan was killed just moments later when his 1995 Jeep Wrangler went over the side of the Pacific Coast Highway near Malibu and landed on its roof at 4:30 p.m. The doctor to the stars was trapped inside his vehicle and suffered major head injuries. He was declared dead at the scene. His dog, Jill, who was the subject of his final tweets, survived the accident.
Really? This is a good... So he was... The implication is that it was him on his phone or whatever, tweeting away as he's speeding down the highway in his car.
Yep.
He is then killed. The dog escapes unharmed, presumably to lead a life of religious fulfillment elsewhere. That's great. I didn't know she had all... This is the thing about the 10 surgeries in one day is news to me. I didn't know that that was the case.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew she'd had all of those. And I should say for the record, I don't think she looks all that bad, but it is creepy because she looks totally different.
Yeah.
She just looks like a different person altogether.
And but, she was a fine-looking person before.
Yeah, so there was nothing wrong with her before. I mean, she looked just dandy. I didn't realize, though, that he had performed all of those things in one day, because that is a little bizarre. I can't even think of what to... I can't, off the top of my head, think of 10 plastic surgeries that you would have.
Well, if you've got cheek implants, that's one. And
you got your
lips.
You got your boob job.
And boob job and liposuction on a couple of different areas. It adds up pretty quick.
Well, that's true. I guess if you're maybe tightening your whole face, that does count as multiple procedures. Because
yeah.
One is like your lips, and then they're doing your eyes and your, okay, your, the obligatory rhinoplasty and so forth. Okay. Here's Dawn Taylor.
Okay. The caller to Dr. Laura, who was bombarded with the N-word, told CNN that she's had a hard time getting over her experience. I have some audio here.
I got your sound up.
This whole episode has upset you so.
Well, after speaking with Dr. Laura, I was just so confused. I was hurt because I was just calling her to get some advice about what I can do about this situation and how to talk to my husband. So the thought of, like I said, I was just calling her to get some help, and I did not expect to hear the things that she said to me. I didn't want to turn this into a racial thing. I just wanted some advice on my relationship.
It's hard to believe that calling Dr. Laura didn't solve all your problems and, in fact, may have just inflamed your irritation further.
And wasn't she calling to ask about her husband making racial comments about her with his friends?
I guess living with him is okay.
So how does... But she didn't want to turn it into a racial thing.
Well, and apparently her husband using the word all the time... That annoys her somewhat. But really, when some guy on the, you know, some woman on the radio says it to her, that is really where, that's where the rubber meets the emotional road, I guess.
She said it made her question whether she herself had done something wrong.
I thought I had honestly said something wrong. Did I do something wrong? Did I say something wrong? And I just wanted to go back and hear the tapes just to make sure that what I said was okay. And, you know, it was just huge. There's no way to explain the feelings you get or how you can react when something like this happens.
So to recap,
all right.
Woman calls Dr. Laura for advice and is somehow shocked and surprised when Dr. Laura turns out to be a world-class ass.
Yes, yes.
The BBC issued an apology for the actions of a weatherman who raised his middle finger at an anchor without realizing the action was caught on camera. Forecaster Thomas Schaffernacker made the gesture during a broadcast after news anchor Simon McCoy joked the weather forecast would be 100% accurate, the BBC reported. The news channel presenter in the studio acknowledged the mistake had been made, and we apologize for any offense caused, a BBC spokesman said. Thomas was not aware that he was on air, and whilst the gesture was only shown for a second, it was not acceptable. Schaffernacker said he did not realize he was on screen when he jokingly showed his middle finger to McCoy and attempted to cover the error by pretending to scratch his chin.
Schaffernacker sounds like some sort of exotic cookie that you'd be able to get at like an Oktoberfest somewhere. You know what I mean? With a sort of powdery covering that's served to me by a girl in braids.
Prior to the live weather bulletin, Schaffernacker wrote on his website, I made a gesture off camera joking with my fellow presenters, and without warning, the camera went live to the weather studio. I'm very sorry for any offense that might have been caused by my actions.
Keep effing that chicken, Frank.
A source close to Steven Tyler says the Aerosmith frontman told The Source that he will be a judge on Fox's American Idol next season. While an official announcement about Tyler has yet to come from Fox and the producers of the show, the source told the Associated Press on Wednesday there is no reason to refute Tyler's account. The Star spoke only on the condition of anonymity because the Star was not authorized to comment publicly on the matter.
Did you see that he fell off the stage again last night? It's like the second time.
Did he really?
Yeah, in like 3 months.
Is that why he's doing American Idol now? Because he knows it's like a job where he can sit down?
I'm sorry. That was me whacking my my headphones into the microphone. I guess it happens. If you played 10,000 concerts in your career, maybe you fall off stage a couple times. I guess the law of averages indicates that sort of thing is bound to occur. But, I mean, yeah, but he's doing that, you know, hello, Pennsylvania, wham, and, you know, right off the stage. And I think he just tumbled right into the fans again. He was apparently unhurt, and then they helped him back on stage. So, you know, there seems to be something wrong with Steven Tyler in that, I mean, he's never been, like, a good-looking guy. I mean, he's sort of he's an interesting-looking man. But he does seem improbably to have held off the aging process for most of his life, and now it all seems to be sort of catching up with him at once.
Well, it seems like he's got that same problem that, like, you know, Keith Richards and, like, Ozzy Osbourne have, is that, you know, he actually looks good for his age, but you can see that the drug-induced brain damage is starting to take its toll.
Or that it's just an aggregate kind of thing. You know, I always sort of take it as read that, I mean, it's like Keith Richards could be sober for 2 weeks and he would probably still sound drunk just because it's... I think after a while, that's a...
What does it mean? It's like your brain just becomes, you know, spongiform after a while.
All right. Well, in any way, so you got that to look forward to. And so it was just, this wasn't him that said that. This was like somebody close to the somebody close to the singer said this.
Right.
All right. Okay.
New on TV tonight, a season 2 opener of Extreme Cuisine with Jeff Corwin on Food Network.
Now, it's Extreme Cuisine. That's not the same. I'm thinking of Bizarre Foods with what's his name.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
That's different. All right. In this one, Jeff Corwin joins members of the Maori tribes for a feast cooked in boiling sulfur springs. He also hunts for green-finned eels, black abalone, and crawfish on the South Island and samples colonial goose. Also on BBC is the final episode of Gordon Ramsay's Great Escape, which I'd never even heard of before now, but it's the series wraps up as Chef Ramsay makes his way to southern India, where the meat lover embraces vegetarianism at an ashram and samples the hottest curry in the world.
And Gordon Ramsay is the guy from not Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah,
Hell's Kitchen. Okay,
yeah.
So this is isn't like the fifth show that he's hosted in the
Something
last year
like
and
that.
A half.
Yeah, he's on TV all the time. You can't get away from him. On Discovery Channel's Pitchmen, a former Marine tries to improve the flashlight, and an inventor wants to carry on his father's life-saving legacy in the second season premiere.
Here's the thing about this show. I saw the ad for that, but it was one of those things where it's like I was, I was watching Mythbusters or something. But it was that thing where I came and I just saw, like, the sound had been turned off, and I just saw a little bit of the actual commercial, like just the video of it, and I didn't feel like going back to watch it. And I was unclear about what it was, but it must be guys pitching
their inventions.
Saying, like, I came up with a great idea for a thing. That is awesome. All right. So is that tonight?
That is tonight.
Okay. I will absolutely watch that.
The Discovery Channel.
Fantastic. All right.
And, of course, it's Thursday, so on Comedy Central, new episode of Futurama. Tonight is The Prisoner of Benda, in which crew members are able to swap minds thanks to a state-of-the-art gadget.
Excellent. And with that, my friends, we will bring down the curtain on this. Legion of News, brought to you each and every weekday by PDX.FM and originates from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Aguilar, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show begins next at rickemerson.com. This has been another exciting episode of
Legion of News on PDX.FM.